Our next speaker is Professor Rosemary Stevens. Professor Stevens has a most impressive career as a historian policy analyst with a degree in English language and literature at Oxford University in England. She holds an MPH degree in health services administration and policy and a PhD in epidemiology, both at, from Yale University. Professor Stevens is one of those amazing intellectuals who can bridge that space between deep historical arguments and current policy debates. As just one example of this, she has published 7 books and numerous articles and has chaired or been a member of national policy committees on subjects as diverse as civil rights in health, traumatic brain injury, and Medicare as a social contract. I'd be hard-pressed to highlight one of her books because they are all important must-reads. But let me just mention her most recent, the Public-Private Healthcare State, Essays on the History of American Healthcare Policy. Right here. You can tell I've been reading it. And it's been a joy. As we continue to struggle under current healthcare reform debates with notions of public versus private provision in healthcare services, Professor Stevens' book makes clear just how old and enduring that struggle really is. Every time I hear Professor Stevens talk, I come away with amazing new insights, and I know that will be the case today. So without further ado, please welcome Professor Rosemary Stevens.
Thank you very much, Colleen, for your introduction and for a plug, too, for the book. Much appreciated. And I'm very pleased to be here. Actually, I started off my career with graduate education in social services and hospital administration in England. So it's kind of a homecoming, in a way, to be here today. Beatrix, that was a terrific talk. Didn't you find that some of these themes were horribly familiar? Oh, my goodness. I mean, we may be going through the whole thing right now, all over again, with déjà vu. And a second, I think, very important element of Beatrix's work here, as well as in other work, is that how far back this idea of a safety net goes. And it's kind of strange in a way, because countries with national health insurance or 100% coverage, theoretically at least, don't have to worry so much about a safety net. It's a very American concept in a way, and it's something that that we need to think about a lot. So that we don't get too involved in thinking about, well, that's the safety net, and not doing what Michael Davis, you knew I was going to get back to Michael Davis, what Michael Davis would have seen in terms of how we provide health services for the whole of society. He was both an amazing practical reformer in pushing for programs like pay clinics, and in working on many different with many different groups, including the Committee on the Costs of Medical Care in the 1930s and the Committee on the Nation's Health. So he had this wonderful range, both of practical reform and social philosophy, and it's the social philosophy side I want to talk a bit about today. Can you hear me back there? Good. Good, I think. I hope. So where's my timing? I have a three-part talk here, briefly. One, I want to look at some questions, some movements that were happening during Michael Davis's own life. He wrote his first book, published his first book in 1906. He died in 1971. I could have met him, actually, because I was in the States in 1971, but I did not. And I really, really regret that, but some of you here may have met him. And I say that partly, too, because we live history. We're all historians, and the older you get, the more of a historian you find you are, because you remember more going back in time. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the themes of Michael Davis. Then I want to have a brief section on some of the things that I think are worth pointing out as to what's happened in health policy since he died in 1971. And then some thoughts, part three. Maybe some questions. Michael Davis always associated questions of insurance, health insurance, with questions of healthcare organization. In 1916, for example, he wrote a very interesting article on the organization of medical care. And he said, well, the organization, you can't really talk about the organization of medical care because the whole system is disorganized. 1916, nearly 100 years ago. If you have a specialization in healthcare, even at the level that was there in 1916, if you have specialization of function, you've got to have organization and coordination in order to give efficient and effective care. And I stress this now because we've got so bound up in the last few years in thinking about costs, funding streams, accessibility through insurance, that we've almost lost track of the organization of healthcare, and perhaps the nearest we've got to it is sort of diversion by assuming that somehow or other computerized record systems are going to coordinate for us, which of course they won't. The use of health insurance itself as a vehicle for organizational reform, you know, let's have health insurance for everybody, but then let's attach that to organizational reform, was made explicit well before the Second World War, as in Michael Davis's own article, but with other people, but an idea which was generally espoused by experts in healthcare in the 20s and 30s. And the Committee on the Cost of Medical Care, which reported in 1932, its final report. The Committee on the Cost of Medical Care, if you haven't seen those reports, please do. They stand up very, very well as health services research and social research to this day. Whole series of reports, Committee on the Cost of Medical Care. But the committee's final report said there has to be organized payment for healthcare, but there also have to be organized services. So, and then there was a great debate. I remember this debate because my mentor was Isidore Falk, who was involved in, he was directed studies for the Committee on the Cost of Medical Care. And I came into this country in the 1960s when Falk was in his 60s. So, and he was making this point in the 60s. You've got to have the organization of healthcare somehow or other solved or better or dealt at least in the focus, because how can you have comprehensive health insurance in a disorganized system? Well, we know how to have pretty comprehensive health insurance, in a disorganized system. And it's very, very costly, among other things, and there are great concerns about it. From time to time, there have, of course, been efforts to stimulate better organization of care or coordination of care. For example, the Wagner-Murray-Dingle bills for health insurance in the 1940s were based on primary care. So that if indeed those bills had been passed, although there was no chance of passage at the time, if they'd been passed, we would have had something called primary care to an extent that we've never been able to create today, even though we talk hopefully about the medical home today. And there were at the same time, of course, ideological associations made between efforts to develop service systems based on health insurance and the whole real threat of socialized medicine, quote, which you've written about, Beatrix, in the earlier days, socialized medicine, the bugaboo that still appears today, and it still sort of sends shivers up many people's spines, even though nobody seems to know exactly what it is. Instead, of course, the federal government role became non-directional, so that we've developed a system. I'm jumping beyond Davis's time here for speed. We've developed a system in which estimates suggest that 60% of the costs of healthcare are actually governmental of one sort or another. If you add in all the subsidies and you add in what states spend and spend on their own employees and federal services and so forth, they're of course not organized to be used as a vehicle for change. But we have developed increasing amount of government support in non-directional ways. And during Michael Davis's lifetime, much of that was seeing the federal government as what you might call now as a venture capitalist, putting money into two programs which were sought by others. And just for three examples that showed how federal programs have stimulated a health economy based on biomedicine and technology, which is what we now have, and which has encouraged physicians to become entrepreneurial specialists and other health professions too. Take the three examples after World War II. When the Veterans Administration was linked with Veterans Administration hospitals were linked with medical schools, developed residences in specialties, focused on specialization and research. Just as one example, in the late 1980s, the VA was operating then the largest healthcare system in the U.S., but it was but less than 2% of all family practice residences were in VA facilities, compared, for example, with 33% of the residences in nuclear medicine. So there's a big message coming out here that specialization is better than primary care. It's more advanced. It's more what we want. So VA was sending that message. The second unconnected program was the Hill-Burton Act of 1946, which gave federal subsidies to community hospitals to build new centers for specialized medicine across the United States. Well, it didn't say it was to build new centers for specialized medicine, but that is in fact what they did. So we get the whole idea of specialization as mainstream medicine, and again, another set of messages. And the third major program we might mention was NIH, of course, the growth of specialized institutes, one after the other, sending out a message about specialization at the forefront of healthcare, and also the subspecialty fellowships that have been developed through NIH, providing not just specialization, but subspecialization and trainees in medical centers. We could now, looking back as historians, see these three developments, VA, Hill-Burton, NIH, in retrospect as parallel attempts to build a high-tech infrastructure for an emerging healthcare industry. But at the time, of course, they were not seen. They were three rather different responses to different public-private constituencies, people pressing for veterans benefits, people pressing for rural development, people pressing for scientific leadership. Nevertheless, what we've seen over the years since then is that federal health policy can really be characterized as a composite of multiple requests, successful requests. By the end of the 1960s, that is in the decade before Michael Davis died, I've always wanted to use the phrase irrational exuberance, so I use it. Healthcare policy was the product of it. There was really irrational exuberance in the national in the 1960s. This one program after another was developed in the Great Society and afterwards to plaster over cracks in care and meet the demands of special interests. Good interests, you know, these were you and me often pressing for clinics and so forth. In the late 1960s, there were federal programs in 221 federal agencies and departments, from the Children's Bureau, which we've heard of, to the Small Business Administration. And there were 14 or more agencies engaged in healthcare educational programs. This was a mess. At the same time, there was an accretion of experts, us, you know, all of us in a way. There were 407 advisory groups to the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare in 1970, involving 5,500 people. I was on one of these, actually, to develop the National Center for Health Services Research and Development, which eventually morphed into ARC, Research Agency. So, by 1970, it was possible to say, and I agree with this statement, a health pack, which was regarded as a left-wing a pressure group at the time, a health pack report in 1970 said, you'll like this, health is no more a priority of the American healthcare industry than safe, cheap, efficient, pollution-free transportation is a priority of the American automobile industry. All right, here we go again. At this point, by 1970, we had Medicare and Medicaid. So I now go on to the period beyond Michael Davis's death in 1971. I'm not going to channel Michael Davis; I wouldn't dare. But let's make some comments here. Michael Davis died 5 years after the implementation of Medicare in 1966. In 1971, Medicaid programs were developing in different states. There was optimism among healthcare experts, or there was at least some optimism among healthcare experts. My own mentor, Isidore Falk, spoke at the funeral tribute to Michael Davis in 1971. I could say that in the United States we now have a declared national policy asserting that good medical care should be available to everyone in the nation. Good words. And Falk largely attributed this move to Michael M. Davis, who had really been pressing on all fronts during his lifetime. Even in 1971, though, the promise of America as a great society, Lyndon Johnson's promise, was on the wane, although Richard Nixon had some very interesting ideas which unfortunately were not fulfilled. The Nixon administration tried to expand access to health care through tax credits, but there was Medicaid got in the way of that, because how can you expand people's income if you don't take medical care into account? And so there was a notch effect. Also, the Nixon administration showed some promise of developing a network of new, privately operated, competitive healthcare organizations from the ground up, service delivery organizations from the ground up, along the lines of the Kaiser Permanente programs on the West Coast. What was the name applied to this movement? Health maintenance organizations, which then meant service delivery systems, and of course the term has become utterly, as many terms have, utterly weakened and attenuated, and now really means insurance. I actually worked on some background papers with health education and welfare in 1970, and wow, were we optimistic. We liked the market mechanisms serving social and organizational goals. We had long discussions about laissez-faire and the regulation that was going to make laissez-faire in healthcare work. And we noted with joy that a market system of competing health maintenance organizations would require much better information about healthcare for consumers. So, I mean, that was a very brave set of proposals. But think how much it might have cost if indeed what we would now see as infrastructure funds had been provided to jumpstart new Kaiser programs or equivalents across the country. In the early 1970s, the huge amount of money for the venture capital, the startup costs, and the consulting services that would necessarily go with it. It was a very bold set of programs, but it was actually not realistic in the budgetary context of the time. And we keep coming back to budget, unfortunately. So the HMO, the actual HMO legislation of 1973 was watered down because it included insurance networks which were divorced from the actual provision of healthcare. Attempts to influence healthcare provision through managed care in the 1990s, I'm jumping, through the private insurance system, as we all know, failed. Managed care became labeled as overly restrictive. Patients seemed to feel they had a right, coming back to your points, Beatrix, patients seemed to think they had a right to be able to go directly to specialists, including Medicare, but also in the private sector. And it turned out that private regulation was no more palatable to the society at large, no more palatable than public regulation. So since we didn't have much public regulation, I think actually the managed care movement is going to be reassessed as actually a very interesting attempt to provide some rational structures of care to healthcare, but of course it bombed, was extremely unpopular and bombed. And now we see advertisements. I saw one this morning as I was having breakfast, advertisements which say, you know, from insurers which say direct access to specialists as one of the common issues. Medicare, of course, has always had some organizational clout since the beginning, although Medicare has never been used deliberately and comprehensively in order to affect the delivery of care. I think that's a very interesting thing for us to think about today. Should Medicare, in order to save Medicare, how should Medicare be used to affect the organization of healthcare and the delivery of healthcare in the future? It's an open question. I mean, Medicare, of course, has influenced the delivery of healthcare, but inadvertently often by stimulating the demand for services. But it's also more deliberately required racial desegregation of patients in hospitals. Medicare developed a very important research program. Medicare earmarks program payments for graduate medical education, which is interesting in itself. And payments to hospitals with a disproportionate share of low-income patients. And in recent years, it's become bolder in specifying what should be covered and what will not be covered. Also, Medicare was fundamental in adopting diagnosis-related groups, DRGs, in the early 1980s. But in other ways, for example, is trying to push people into more comprehensive insurance coverage, like the Medicare Advantage plans. There's been a very mixed reception, very mixed results from that in terms of, it's sort of a wishy-washy, in my view, way of easing up to trying to do something about providing a more comprehensive medical care and not getting all the way. We won't even talk about Medicare Part D. So our big question today in the Davis tradition is how best can Medicare be reformed? Or can it be reformed? And Medicaid? Well, Medicaid's a bit ahead. But how can Medicare be reformed to improve the delivery of healthcare? I think in some ways Medicaid has had to be more adventurous because of the impact of Medicaid on state budgets. And state health care reforms have been looking more at service provision, and there's a lot of research to be done on reform, health care reform in the different states in relation to providing services as well as in extending access to care as, for example, has happened in Massachusetts. All right, to finish up with my so whats. I've got lots of so whats, so I'll stop when I'm waved at and my time is up. There you are. Right. I suppose one of the things we can learn is deja vu, but let's not do that because that does not very is not very helpful sometimes. But some things we can learn from Davis's outlook on healthcare. First of all, is his flexibility of views. He sponsored paid clinics. He, a little later, I think, tried to push hospitals to have hospital-centered healthcare in communities. He worked, of course, on graduate education here in 1934, the first hospital administration program. And I don't know if you're aware that one of the things that he hoped to do with this was to press for the values of voluntary hospitals as standard setters for the United States. Well, that's interesting to observe. First of all, because he was stressing social values, which were supposedly housed in not-for-profit hospitals, voluntary hospitals, in the 1930s. And secondly, because we're not at all clear today whether not-for-profit hospitals have any values different from for-profit hospitals. Nevertheless, I want to emphasize that Davis constantly talked about both flexibility, or as if you're doing reform, you have to be flexible to work with what you've got, but also don't forget the overall values of what you want to achieve, and that's community values, social values, and his first book was on psychological aspects of society. And he was always interested in things like social unity, social function, the relationship between what we put into healthcare and other schemes, and what it says about us as a democracy. So, mission. So, flexibility, values, mission. The responsibility of experts such as us. Responsibility of experts is to explicate values, to challenge them when appropriate, and design reforms that are not only workable, but socially advantageous. Well, this is just words, but they're words that need to be repeated, and to advance these values via education and research. So the fourth, after mission, is research itself, health services research. Much health service research has necessarily, perhaps, in the last few years, been addressed to a payment quality appraisal, which links to payment and costs. But to Michael Davis, medical economics, the phrase that he used for research, medical economics meant much more than applying econometrics or financial concepts to healthcare. It meant studying the medical economy as part of the social economy, having a very wide view. And I really do feel myself that it is the duty of graduate programs not to challenge the status quo, but also to develop a long-term vision as to what kind of society, as well as what kind of healthcare system we would like, even if past reforms, as we note, have largely failed. What have we got to lose if past reforms have failed? By putting in more ideas into the complex that may or may not work. Fifth, I think this is the importance of recognizing where I began, that we still have a disorganized healthcare system. Why? I think it's a very good time now with all parties, the medical profession, insurers, hospitals, patients, computer whizzes. Who else have I left out? Social workers, thank you. Politicians, add yourself in. Lobbyists, I think we have got a coalescence of views where it may be more possible, may or may not be more possible, to think more broadly about what is it we're delivering, what's the product, how can we make the product better within the system we now have. So I hope there's a lot of research being done in this school as elsewhere on what we would like to see broader than, you know, how would we measure quality or how would we extend access, important though those are being done. There's also the values that some of which need to be stressed in relation to this, in relation to why, this is a six, I guess, why do we have the system that we have? Colleen, you mentioned the report that I chaired on Medicare as social contract in the 1990s. It was very worrying then to find out that by the late 1990s, younger legislators, bureaucrats, and even policy analysts in Washington had little knowledge of the principles behind social insurance. They didn't know what social insurance meant. Little tolerance for the principles of social solidarity, risk sharing, and fairness that are inherent in social insurance as traditionally conceived, that should be inherent in Medicare. So there's a job to be done, a conceptual job to be done, bringing back a wider community and social goals. And finally, I think we all need better protection. We all need a better safety net, not just the obvious candidates for safety net protection who may find their clinics closed on them, and obviously are of vital importance. But all of us need better protection one way or another. The one-third of Medicare patients who are readmitted to hospital within 90 days. You know, where's the follow-up care? That's an organizational question. Cost is incidental, $17 billion a year. The cancer patient whose chemotherapy pills are not covered by Medicare Part B. The hospital patient treated in hospital by a hospitalist who doesn't have a primary care doctor, and again, the middle class patient whose doctors opt out of Medicare. I don't know whether this is happening in Chicago or elsewhere, but in New York, there are doctors, including my gynecologist, who's opted out of Medicare entirely. The optimist who hopes that computerized records or patient-centered records will substitute for lack of healthcare coordination. Recent article by David Blumenthal in the New England Journal. The wealthy, even the wealthy industrialist who inadvertently chooses inadequate care by talking to his pals, just as he encountered Mr. Madoff. I always want to say Madoff. Mr. Madoff. All right, so we have a mission. And I'd like just to, I know I'm going 1 minute over time, but I want to quote Michael Davis himself with all of these. Our hopes must rest upon the courage of those who appreciate human needs and are willing to face mistakes rather than to delay action. Upon the wisdom of those who think of social accomplishments as well as science, and upon the goodwill of the millions who have it in their hearts to fulfill democracy as well as to defend it. Thank you.